This is Catherine McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
After the hour of 7 o'clock here on the the west coast of the United States. Joining me is a friend of the program, Sage 5'2"?
6'2".
Damn it, I hate when I do that. Sage 6'2". That is former, retired Marine Corps Brigadier General Tom Droughty, formerly the CO of the Fighting 5th Marine Regiment. He joins the program from, are you in Tampa, Tom? Where are you?
Yeah, it's just north of Tampa, OUTZ, just out of the boundary.
All right. The, first of all, as you said to me when we came on, happy, Independence Eve to you. Hello?
Mac, I hear a lot of music in the background there.
Is that better?
There you go. Okay. I thought your voice had changed there.
No, I wish I'd be making a lot of money if it had.
Well, there's a little different attire and hairstyle, I'm sure, as well.
You know what? That's exactly the case. The so happy Independence Eve there, Droughty.
And to you as well.
I want to have you on and just do a liberal arts discussion about you know, we celebrate the 4th of July and it tends to be about fireworks and getting together, focus on food and fireworks and getting together with whoever you're getting together with. Hopefully it's some family. But it tends to be neighbors and whatnot during the course of the summer. A lot of times at lake places and community events and around the nation. But I think it's prudent always to bust the Declaration of Independence out and read it. Because to me it is one of the great. It's my favorite document. And in a series of incredible world-altering documents that have influenced governments and the formation of governments since they were written in the latter part of the 18th century. And so I would tell you, your assignment is before Monday, read the Declaration of Independence. What I love about it is that they were pissed when they wrote it, and it comes through in the writing. They were pissed.
You know, it's interesting you should say this. I'm just reading it. Wikipedia has a really fine piece on the Declaration, and it says that this sentence, which I'm about to read, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, has been called one of the best-known sentences in the English language, containing the most potent and consequential words in American history. And, those five words, all men are created equal, you know, literally changed the world. That there was this upstart group that said, you know, you're based not on how you were born, or your wealth, or your title, or anything else, but that all men are created equal. And it's such inspiring, soaring rhetoric. The Constitution can be a little tough to read at times, but everybody should read that as well. But the Declaration of Independence is really special. I couldn't agree more.
You know, it's kind of interesting when you look at the genesis of that, phrase, all men are created equal. And in my opinion, historically, you know, all men were not created equal. They lived in a world that certainly wasn't equal. And the genesis of that statement is Christ. Christ's message that everybody lepers, women, men, you know, children, you know, no matter what, you're all children of God's. And it's a, you know, and I know the Greeks, you know, the philosophies of the Greeks and all that, but Christianity is the great evangelical tool of this notion that we're all equal in God's eyes, because the world wasn't that way. So I think it's interesting to kind of, when you crawl down that rabbit hole of the historical underpinnings of these kind of thoughts, who spread them around the world, and how we get to July 4th.
Yeah, you're exactly right, because after that statement, all men are created equal, that they're endowed by their creator. I think of the audacity by current standards of a group of people talking about a creator, about something spiritual that has to do with their, you know, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I mean, it's a thought that I've had for a long, long time. And right now on the treadmill, I'm reading the Federalist Papers, which are fascinating. But how blessed we were with our founding fathers, and I just have to see the hand of God in the choice of those men. And at times I used to say an interesting cocktail party question was, do times make the men, or do men make the times? And when you think about our founding, how critical it was to have the men that we did at that time, and the things that they said and did, and the intricacies of the Constitution, and, you know, simple majorities and 3/5 and 2/3. I mean, all of those things that is like a finely constructed watch that is run, maybe not perfectly, but with the ability to modify it when necessary. It's just truly, I think, the hand of God that was in our creation, Mac.
You know, it's when you look at our founding documents, they are, I mean, they're revolutionary in nature in terms of, you know, throwing off this yoke of feudalism and the notion of a monarchy for another form of government that had never existed on the planet, And, you know, and so to me, it's this, you know, you have, you know, these colonists, you know, that are subjects of the king. And on this date, they declare independence on July 2nd. And then they said that, well, we need to articulate this to the American people. And they adopted the final edits on July 4th. So I think it's so to me, it's when you think about the notion, and we're, you know, we've been raised on it, right? But in terms of men of their time, they're exceptional men. And then the thing I think is so interesting that you see even today in the country, and they were extremely smart in the way they built the whole, in terms of what they did in the Constitution. There's this constant check and balance. The Electoral College that people say is outdated, to me is not, because the Electoral College is attempting to, as you see all throughout the Constitution, to balance the idea of a numerically superior city and a rural state. How do we balance that? How do we keep the major cities from around the nation from simply dominating the country? Well, we're going to create this thing called the Electoral College. And so, I mean, that decision echoes still in our history in our most recent election. Win the popular vote. So you win the major cities, but you lose the election in the Electoral College because the nation doesn't buy what you're selling, although the big cities do. And it goes back to our founding documents, as just to echo your sentiment of the brilliance of the people who sat down and put it together, and every step of the way trying to make sure that tyranny could not exist, that progress would be slow. So it's you can see the themes that were in their head in their work.
Yeah, and you get a system that is so brilliant because, in addition to providing the authority and power, it also protects And think of that, a document, a constitution, a basis of government that protects its citizens as well as empowers various aspects of it. So that, I think, is a part of that checks and balances to ensure that, that there is not going to be a monarchy, that we would not go to war at the whim of somebody because he was irritated or jealous or avarice or whatever the case may be, that the people would be protected by this form because, after all men are created equal, and therefore they deserve the protection of this this fine document and the things that went along with it, the Bill of Rights that would amplify it. Yeah, and one of the things that I was thinking about after you gave me a heads up here, Mac, is how critical it is for our listeners, because some of them are not as old as me, because I'm probably the oldest guy. But for those who have an understanding of civics and of history, that on this holiday, and recreation is wonderful, and time with family, I couldn't agree more, is so precious. But to just, you know, take a few minutes with the kids and endure the eye rolling and the so forth, but just to remind our youngsters, because so many of them do not receive information about history, about civics, but about this great government that we're a part of, so that they're not easily deceived by people who say, well, you know, really, we ought to have a socialist state where the government takes care of everything. You know, really, you know, I think that's been tried in a few cases and it hasn't worked that well, but you can't, you know, really identify that or measure that or evaluate that unless you have an understanding of what our current system is, and that's up to folks like our listeners to pass that on to you, our youngsters. So I hope that in this holiday period that they take just a few minutes and you know, just remind our youngsters of how lucky we are to be Americans and what a tremendous debt we owe to our founding fathers, not only for their brilliance, but also for their guts. I mean, when they signed that thing, they were putting it all on the line. There was no ifs, ands, or buts. I mean, you know, it was a case of there was no turning back. This is irreversible. And so when they said that they were pleasuring each other, our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor, those were not idle words. That took real courage, physical as well as moral.
Well, and legend has it, and I don't know if this is akin to the devil dog legend, but you know, legend has it that the thing that most irritated King George was the fact that they signed it. You know, it's like, it's not like he hadn't seen one of these documents before. I mean, you know, Great Britain had conquered the world. They were the reigning superpower, and there wasn't anybody real close to them. You know, the French, maybe a little bit, but not too much. Now, nobody like the British, and they ruled the world with the Royal Navy and the Royal Army, and King George's his hand, you know, was flung to the far corners of the globe. And so you know, the story is that he was pissed that they signed it. And I was joking, I was kind of doing this little bit last year about, you know, them kind of taking it, you know, when it got sent to King George, you know, so his staff secretary brings it to him along with the chief of staff, and they're kind of wringing their hands, and you know, he's looking in the mirror at his crown to make sure it's on straight, and he looks and he says, "What's up?" And they said, "We got something for you from the colonies." "Oh, really? What do they want?" "Yeah, we just want to kind of give you an overview of it. They want their independence." "What? Not this again." "Did they send a document or how?" "Yes, it's right here, but we don't think you should look at it." "Why not?" It would only anger you, we think. Okay, well,
I don't want to ruin your day here.
Yeah, we don't want to don't want to ruin your day, sire. Okay, well, roll it out. Let me see it. So they roll it out, right? They put the little weights on the four corners because it's rolled up from being in a document case for the journey across the Atlantic. And he looks and he sees the signatures. And he says, you know, what is this? And then he looks at the staff sec and he says, and he points to Hancock's name, "What font is that?" And the staff sec looks and says, "Sorry, I'm afraid to tell you, that's like the fuck you font." And he looks and he goes, He says, that's exactly what font that is. Are you kidding me? All right. Tell the Royal Navy to get ready and put the Royal Army on notice. We're going to go kick their ass. But that's the extent. When they signed that document, it's not like they did this, you know, in anonymity. You know, they put their John Hancock literally in his face. And that to me is, I don't know that it's been done that often like that in the history of the world.
We want our independence. Who wants it? Don't worry about it. We do.
You know, well, that's not the way they did it.
In addition to that, there's no ambiguity here. The indictment, the bill of particulars, documented the king's repeated injuries and usurpations of the Americans' rights and liberties, and talk about the charges and specifications for Article 15 or a court-martial. I mean, you know, everything, you know, for, combined with others, is there the jurisdiction for quartering large bodies of armed troops among us, cutting our trade. I mean, it goes on and on and on. I mean, there's no ambiguity about this. This is what we're rebelling against, and so make no mistake, this isn't a thing of our feelings have been hurt. Here's the, you know, the charges and specifications, and then the denunciation, not only of you, the king, but also our British brethren who are not allowing us to have the representation that we deserve. So it's just an amazing, it's a soaring document that really, so stands by itself. And again, has to be taken in context then with the Constitution that kind of puts it all together, and then the Bill of Rights for those first 10 amendments. It's just an amazing trio that ought to be part of required reading for all of us.
Well, I will tell you, if you haven't read in a while, read it. And the thing that I hadn't read it, and I don't know how many years ago I read it. I don't know what I was doing, but I read it. And what struck me was it's an angry document. When you at the end of it, when I put it down, I thought they were pissed. They were pissed. When they list their grievances, whereas he has, and they list them all. And from quartering to commerce to taxes to all that the King of England had done, they were pissed. And I love it because it's ultimately, and there was no America at the time, but it is the foundation of, you know, this American experiment, and that the world has not seen. Do you have any things that you find fascinating about the document? To me, Jefferson and Adams both, you know, being a part of it, and Ben Franklin being a part of it, to me, you know, you see that kind of intellectual horsepower. And then both the Jefferson and Adams die on July 4th. 1826. Yeah. You know, you see things like this relative to this document. Coincidence, I guess, but holy smokes. Are there things that you find fascinating about it?
Yeah, a couple of things. One is that, with this document, we were fighting with them already. So this is not, you know, news, but this is in addition to the fighting that's going on, this is, again, that Declaration of Independence that is so, as you've indicated, in your face. This is not a series of skirmishes. We're declaring our independence. So, you know, declarative statement of independence is so special. The other is that I just finished reading again on the treadmill the biography on Hamilton, which is just fascinating. I mean, right. One of the most amazing characters of our figures of our founding fathers. I confess. And I'm ashamed that I didn't know much about him, but what a fascinating guy that he was. But how critical he was, because in reading the Federalist Papers, that we had these 13 colonies, but now the 13 independents with their own priorities, their own prejudices, their own desires and so forth. But now to pull that together into a central government was so critical and so difficult the wordsmithing that was so necessary, and again, forgive me, or maybe don't forgive me, but my belief of the divine hand that brought all this together, because otherwise it would have been 13 colonies saying, okay, we're separated from Great Britain, but, you know, pulling together, not so sure. You know, you got the folks on the far north and on the far south, and the agrarian versus the cities, and, I mean, all those things. How much power are we going to concede, and we're going to, you know, have to, form an army and pay for that, and we got, you know, some debts that are, I mean, all of these things that again, with the brilliance of people like Hamilton, that we were so critical in our success. Again, it's an amazing story that I think, unfortunately, is lost on so many Americans who take for granted what we have, and not only what we have, but how we got there.
Let me read you an email, sir. Matt, first of all, always great to hear General Droughty on, and the historical nature of your content this morning is awesome. Gives us all something to think about as well as recall. I think that it's appropriate as a leader in a family or in a group when you're together, and I don't care what the occasion is. It could be Martin Luther King's birth that we celebrate. It could be President's Day. It could be Memorial Day, Labor Day, or the 4th of July. But when you're a leader, I think it's your responsibility, when you say grace, you mention these things and you reflect on them. So young people, some of them won't be interested, and they will roll their eyes, as General Droughty mentioned. But there will be others that will be impacted. And you are seed planting, leading them to a better life in a more enlightened way, as well as setting an example. So for everybody out there, when you get ready to eat, take a moment, as you should, whether it be the Memorial Day weekend, to remind everybody that it wasn't their dreams, and then in parentheses he says, I've heard you say this, Mac, it wasn't their dream to be in a national cemetery at the age of 19, that we honor them not only today, but whenever we serve the nation as our tribute to them. It's what made this country what it is. So this 4th of July weekend, please, when you get together to eat, in a short benediction or grace or whatever you call it, remind everybody how fortunate we all are to be born into this experiment, to be winners of the ovarian lottery, as you will, to be born Americans. It is truly a special place with all of our warts. Having traveled around the world, I would choose to live no other place. Semper Fidelis, happy Independence Day. Have a great weekend. Well said.
What a great email. Wow, that is so well stated. I couldn't say anything after that except amen. And it really points out that we sometimes forget the power of stories and how critical that is, especially with our youngsters who learn from stories. And of course, our great teacher Christ used the parables as a way of learning. But as you were talking, I remember when I was the Secretary of the General Staff, under General Buell, God rest his soul, who was the chief of staff, used to have there at the headquarters in our little office Friday cake, and someone would bring in a cake on Friday, and so I said, gee, we're going to have everybody gathered rather than just have cake, which is fine. Let's have this day in history. So I'd have the history division shoot up to us, you know, what happened this day in the Marine Corps on that particular Friday, and the troops that were a part of that, they're just amazing how they would look forward to Friday cake, not just because of not getting cake on Friday, but to get that shot in the arm of this is what it means to be a Marine. This is what people like us who are also Marines and will be until the day they died, the things that they did on this day, whether it's 10 years ago or 50 years ago or 100 years ago, but that's what makes it so special, is that the legacy continues. And for the 4th of July, not just the legacy of the Corps, but the legacy of the country. And that's promulgated by folks like us, Mac, you know, the old guys who remember, who know, and who pass on to the youngsters the things that they really should carry with them.
You know, I think that we don't give young people enough credit in terms of, they don't. Some of them will. There's young people like us that are young people today.
Yep.
And so as adults, don't shrink from your responsibility to expose them to this. And the ones that want to roll their eyes, you know, they'll roll their eyes. But there will be some in the audience that will embrace it and then will listen to you and will get pointed in a better direction. And so we should, you know, don't be afraid of that. Let them roll their, those who will roll their eyes, let them. And, but the ones that are, that won't are waiting, to be told by people that they perceive to be leaders about the better things and the better ways. And so don't shrink from that. And this, and with, and again, it could be the Martin Luther King holiday.
Yep, you bet. We have all kinds of opportunities.
Right. Labor Day devoted to, I mean, we started in this country with child labor and no,
yep,
and no labor laws, right? And now we live in a much different place. And to remind them of our history is, you know, is well and good, and how fortunate we are in the march of it and whatnot. And so, I think that's, I think don't shrink from being a leader in your community and your family and all of that. There's one other thing. Historically, kind of interesting. I want to ask you about Gettysburg. Here's a couple of little, they're not even facts, but just the origin of the document. Jefferson wrote the first draft. The other members of the Declaration Committee and the Continental Congress made 86 changes to Jefferson's original draft, including shortening the overall length by more than a quarter. When writing the first draft of the Declaration, Jefferson primarily drew upon two sources: his own draft of the preamble of the Virginia Constitution, which merits your scrutiny, right, and George Mason's draft of Virginia's Declaration of Rights. So those two documents are the things that Jefferson leaned on the heaviest in terms of creating the Declaration of Independence. All right, anything else relative to the Declaration, Tom, that you would tell us to think about or pay attention to?
Well, it's interesting, with all the alterations, I'm reminded of the saying that it's easier to be an editor than to be an author.
There you have it.
Have an author, you got to have somebody who puts the words down there as a starting point, and oftentimes that's the bravest person around, because he knows that it's going to get shot at, or she knows that it's going to be shot at and put down and modified and so forth. But you got to start somewhere, and thank goodness we had someone with the eloquence of Thomas Jefferson to provide that starting point. But then the brilliance of others to make the modifications. And you know, how would you possibly improve upon the current Declaration of Independence? I would challenge anybody to make it better or to make it more meaningful than it is.
That is an interesting intellectual question, though. How would you make it better? How would you make the Constitution better? How would you, if you were going to rewrite the Declaration of Independence, is there anything that you would put in there that they did not? I think that those are interesting intellectual questions. If you were going to do that.
Yeah, that is a good question. How if the decision is made that it's got to be changed, updated, and so forth, that would be an interesting task.
Right.
But you know, it's different days, different ways, and at the time, what was needed was what was produced. And again, I think there's, back to my initial statement, that divine hand that was guiding people that chose the right words in the right sequence and in the right context for what was needed at that time for this group of 13 colonies to pull together and declare their independence. And then that was just the starting point. And then from there, to really pull together to adopt the Constitution that is the basis for what we have now.
Interesting stuff. Today is July 3rd. I think, let's see,
11:10. I think that we're getting close to the time when Pickett leads his soldiers from the Confederate Army across a pretty flat plain, across the Chambersburg Pike, up towards where General Hancock was, near a copse of trees. Gettysburg, are you a fan of the battle, and yes or no?
Oh, absolutely. I've been there a couple of times. Sandy and I went there in July because we wanted to be there at the same time of year when the battle took place, and with that, a better feel for the sacrifice that was made. You just imagine being there in woolen uniforms, you know, with long underwear, you know, fighting that battle. But when we went to Little Round Top, we were just kind of walking around, and one of the park rangers came up and said, you know, it's interesting, there used to be a guy who came here years ago, and he would just sit here and not do anything. He would just kind of sit here, you know, by himself, and, you know, it wasn't causing a difficulty. So the park rangers kind of wondered, who is this guy and what is he on? So finally one of us asked him, sir, do you need anything? He said, no, thanks, I'm doing fine. And so the question then was, what are you doing? And his response was, I'm listening. And they said, listening to what? And his answer was, I'm listening to ghosts. And the guy's name was Jeff Shara, who wrote that fantastic book called The Killer Angels. And just amazing how he got his inspiration, if you will, by going there and just absorbing, if you will, the ambience, if you will, of Little Round Top. The other story that always touched me was after Pickett's charge, you know, when they reached it's called the high water mark of the Confederacy, and they're pulling back, that the remnants of his army pulled back, walking backwards. So they retreated facing the Union lines. And the reason, and I asked this in class, why was that? And again, a tribute to youngsters who said, because they didn't want to get shot in the back. And that was the exact answer, because after all that they had done, they didn't want someone to perceive them as being a coward by being shot in the back. I mean, it's just an amazing whole series of stories about Gettysburg, but it's one of my favorite spots. It truly is.
In terms of the campaign, what did you what strikes you about the campaign? Because there's so many. To me, it's such an interesting. It's such an interesting piece of American history. So much was written on the backside of it. As a military guy, when you look, there's so much. I mean, Stuart's absence and Lee not knowing, you know, the movements of the Army of the Potomac to the events of day one. His admonishment to Heth, go to Gettysburg to find, you know, to essentially. So, you know, he was looking for shoes, but they were going to go foraging. And but do not bring on a general engagement. Got it. And he does exactly that. The Union performance on every day, it seems like this is the first time that the Union has quality generals and leaders, from Buford leading the cavalry to Reynolds leading First Corps, and the decisions that those two make in tandem, which really set up the battle, because Buford and Reynolds there only briefly before being killed, they see that the ground's imminently defensible. And so, and then on day two, decisions that get made on the left flank, General Warren, the division engineer officer, seeing the flanking movement and issuing orders, and then ultimately a brigade commander by the name of Strong Vincent, who's from Pennsylvania, brings his brigade to Little Round Top on his own initiative, after intercepting a courier, and it sets the stage for that fight. And it seems like every time it's in doubt, Union leaders step into that, and it hasn't happened before in the war. They've always come up short.
and they pull it out. And then on day three, Lee lines up. You know, everybody says, oh, it's suicide. No, it wasn't. He lined up 278 pieces of artillery, hub to hub to hub, and he was going to blow the center of the Union line right through that ridge. And the Artie guys screwed it up. Most of the artillery after it got foggy went over the ridge line. And so they didn't, if they would have done the damage that Lee drew up for them, they would have penetrated the center of that position and they would have fought there that day, and it would not have been a rout, certainly. And we would have seen who would have fled the field. So how about you? So are there any things about that battle that when you think of Gettysburg stand out for you as a military guy?
Yeah, you mentioned one that is always one of the forgotten heroes in my mind, and that's Buford.
Yeah.
You know, had he not been as quick on the draw that he was to realize what is in front of him, and that the only thing that he could do to save not just the Union Army, but to save the Union, although I'm not sure that he had that heady an inspiration, but more of a tactical thing, he had to buy time. And his ability and his quickness to do exactly that, of, you know, send back, get the Union up here, get to the defensible ground, with the time that I'm going to buy you by engaging and deceiving as much as possible Lee's army as to what he has in front of them. Because as you pointed out, Stuart was off not doing his job, and that was one of the great failures. So, the role of Buford, who, I think doesn't get the credit that he deserves, and really setting that battle up, for success for the Union, it was really critical. And then, of course, as well known with the book, The Killer Angels, Joshua Chamberlain, and, you know, here's this, college professor who read, and who became a soldier, not through experience, but more through his reading and his desire to perform well, and to just realize that when everything else was lost, you just fix bayonets and charge, and with that broke the charge of the troops from Alabama primarily, and saved, because had that fallen, we just know what would have taken place on the Union far left flank. They just wouldn't right on down the line. So, you know, so many cases. The role of the engineers that you point out, the Union engineers who appreciated terrain maybe more than the infantry guys did. And so I think hats off to the folks that you mentioned in that regard and the role that they had. And, of course, Lee was an engineer when he was first commissioned out of West Point. Lee's not listening to Longstreet. You know, was one of his trusted advisors. But being the headstrong guy that he was, this was where the fight was going to be. And then the failure on the part of the Union to pursue. But at the end of, you know, being, I guess, so exhausted or being content with what had taken place that they let that go as well. So lots of lessons learned from that tremendous battle. And for any of the listeners, I would just say, if you ever get a chance to go to Gettysburg, for God's sakes, do so and plan to spend at least a day there. And even then, you're just going to be touching, you know, some of the highlights. I don't know about you, Mac. What would you say about that?
No, I would say before you go, read so that you can maximize your time there. Because if all you're going to go do is drive around the battlefield, you know, you're missing so much of what happened there. So I mean, there's Jay Luboss, God rest his soul, wrote the U.S. Army War College Guide to the Battle of Gettysburg, and it's a great introduction, and you can use it as a guide on the battlefield, and they have an audio version of that now, I think, at the visitor center that you can rent and then bring back to them. But it gives you excerpts from the official records. It takes you to certain places and explains certain things. But I would say if you're going to go and you love history, do a little reading before you go, and it'll make and history will actually come alive.
Yeah,
I used to do a toot, go up and take lieutenants from IOC, and I thought, you know, this is a waste. And you would have loved this, sir. So what I did was I went to the Library of Congress, National Archives, looking for first
person accounts of what happened there. And we only looked at, I want to say four or five decisions, during the fight. So, you know, we spent the day going and looking at decisions, and then different lieutenants were assigned to be different people. And you stood up and you said, "I'm James Longstreet. I'm from Georgia. I graduated with an engineering degree from the University of North Carolina. I entered the Army. I exited the Army." And, you know, and it tells who, this is what I've done. This is who I am as I stand here today. And then they would read Longstreet's writings after the war, some self-serving, like everybody's were. But you know, on this day, I, and the pronouns I, and you're sitting on the ground, right? And you're sitting there, and it's awesome. Because history is coming alive. You're looking at Plum Run, or you're looking at the wheat field, and he's describing coming through a tree line, and they've kept the battlefield as close, and that's why what you said, sir, in terms of going there in July when the vegetation is similar, but not similar, because back then we used wood for everything, firewood, so the tree lines maybe not as substantial. You know, because they were foraged all the time for firewood and things like that. So, but, yeah, I would say go. And, you know, when history comes alive, it's pretty cool. And that is one of if that battle goes the other way, maybe Philadelphia is threatened, Harrisburg falls, and maybe we begin a negotiated settlement to the American Civil War, which only probably has us fighting another Civil War at a later date. So it's an incredibly pregnant battle and really interesting. The decision not to pursue, to me, is always an interesting one. But the Union had never won, right? They had never beaten Lee. And so to me, to cut them a little slack, like they looked around like, what just happened? Did we just win? Did they really leave? Because they always win. They always found a way. And even in their ineptitude, Stuart not there, you know, on day two. I mean, they come within an eyelash. It's really too late in the day to run them out of town on day one. Day two, we're going to get after them. Day two, they come within a whisker of doing it.
Yeah.
And I would argue that on day three, except for the Artie guys screwing it up, they penetrate the center. Hancock dies near the copse of trees. If the Artie guys do what they're supposed to do. But they screw it up. And history is written differently. And all those rounds they shot wound up in the Army's field trains back behind that ridgeline. And that is not where they're supposed to land, boys and girls. So see, that's why artillery types, General Neal aside maybe, gotta supervise them, okay? That's why God invented infantrymen to supervise artillerymen. Because of Gettysburg. So, no, it's one of my favorite battles of all time to study.
Yeah.
Because there's so many lessons. And there was so much written about it afterwards. If you get a copies of the Southern Historical Society papers or the official records, and you see, you know, the original documents during the war, you see what they wrote, it's fascinating, fascinating, fascinating stuff. If you can't tell, I love it.
Yeah. Now, Mac, in case you're... listeners don't understand the term. You used the term toot. So how about letting them know what that means?
Be it tactical exercise without troops. So we would go up there, and we essentially did a little bit of a tour of the battlefield, you know, a little round top and you know, go west of town and show them, you know, this is where the day one fight occurred. But you can imagine as you throw during the toot, you say, okay, we're going to look at this decision. You know, you're all going to be, you know, the leaders here. You're going to be Meade. You're going to get these dispatches, right? And you know where, because of Buford, you know exactly where Lee is. Buford's between he's in along the ridgeline, right? As Meade heads north, from the Rappahannock, he turns and heads north quickly, faster than Lee thought, but Lee doesn't know it. And Buford's in every pass on the Blue Ridge. And he's not allowing Lee's, you know, just their local scouts to be able to see where the Union Army is. So he doesn't know. And in fact, his famous statement, "I feel like I'm going into this fight with one shoe off." And that's because Stuart was not there to tell him where he was. So to me, when you begin to hear those first person accounts, it's inspiring just to be there when you hear it and you can look at what the leaders did on the battlefield. It's absolutely riveting. But with the intent of this, to let a lieutenant know that, God, I just felt like that on, you know, on our movement to contact. I had to make a decision. I didn't have everything I needed, and so I had to evolve the solution. I had to do what was best, and then as I got more information, I continued to evolve it till I got it to work, and holy smokes, that's what this guy was doing. And so I think it opens up a whole, for a military professional, I think it opens up a whole course of study that professionals ought to embark on. And so to me, it was wonderful to come up at the end of the day when you're having a beer in a bar down in Gettysburg with lieutenants that you've done this stuff with, to come up for them to sit around and talk to you and say, you know, sir, I don't even like history. This was awesome. This was awesome. If you do Longstreet's counter march on day two, at they think they're going to come out on the flank. And Lafayette McClaws is a division commander. He's leading, and he sticks his head through the tree line, which is just like opposite of Little Round Top, and he gets blasted by two battalions of artillery that are in the peach orchard. And you can imagine McClaws turns around and looks at Longstreet and says, yeah, I'm not exactly sure how you define flank, but normally when you're on a flank, you don't get your ass smoked by two battalions of artillery. I could be stupid here today, I'm not sure, but you know, you can imagine what, you know, they were dealing with. And so you're sitting there reading it, you know, from yonder small copse of trees in a peach orchard. The flashes of a battalion's worth of artillery began to fire. The smoke settled in Plum Run. And you're reading it, and you're sitting there going, McClaws must have been pissed. We were going to go get out on the Emmitsburg Pike, and we were going to get online and roll it up like Chancellorsville. Well, it ain't happening. And so then you just see the adjustments. Longstreet extends the flank, extend it to the south with Hood and McClaws and all that, and then we're going. And that was probably the beauty there of the Army of Northern Virginia. They had good leaders. They were battle tested, and they knew it wasn't going to be perfect, and they had always pulled it out. But at Gettysburg, at every one of those places, they are met by equal generalship and officership and leadership from the Union side, and that's why it's riveting to study and great professional stuff. Is there a moment? You have a moment? There's so many cool things up there. Is there a moment up there that you enjoy?
I guess a couple. One is, of course, a Little Round Top. The other is going over to where Lee met Pickett's remnants when they returned. And, stood there and said, took responsibility for everything. You know, I'm sorry. And you know, Pickett's men saying, sir, you know, we can do it. just amazing the feeling that you have. And again, to be there makes it also special. Something. Also, to go over to the high water mark of the Confederacy and to see how fragile and how that almost broke. Also, the friendships that were so much a part of battle that are so touching, and I know you're aware of those, but you know, best friends who were on opposite sides of each other. It's just hard to understand, I guess, for us as Americans to think of a country divided as we were in the Civil War.
You know, when you think about your battle buddies, you know, guys who you fought with in Vietnam, to think that you would be now opposed to them, I mean, it would be gut-wrenching. Like, it's hard for me to even envision that we would be on opposite sides fighting each other. And the anxiety, you know, as well as, you know, one of the things I think is really interesting about Robert E. Lee in particular, you know, he is this staid, stately American general that, you know, that stays with Virginia and ultimately commands the Army of Northern Virginia. But in his mind, He is the University of Miami's football team back in the day. Their current football team is a little bit toned down from this, but he is a confident, cocky. He is never afraid to bet on the Army of Northern Virginia, ever. You know, at Antietam, I remember being there with Jay Luboss and General Kelly, and well, now General Craparotta, General Osterman, General Clarity. We're all captains. Kelly's a major. And I asked Jay Luboss, what don't we understand about Robert E. Lee here? That he's going to fight with a single fording site behind the Army of Northern Virginia with both flanks tied into a river. If he loses, his army's destroyed in that river or between their current positions in the river. And Luboss looks at me, and he looks at everybody, and he smiles. He goes, this is going to be a fun day. And he said, Lee is confident to the point of arrogance. He never portrays himself like that, but he is supremely confident in his army. If, you know, the swagger of guys like Stewart, of guys like Stonewall Jackson, of guys like Longstreet, they had incredible leaders in the Confederate Army, in the Army of Northern Virginia. And Lee is, right, if you take away the white beard and all that, he is a cocky, cocky general, supremely confident, and not afraid to taste risk. He knows who he's fighting McClellan. He knows McClellan from years back. He knows McClellan can't make a decision, and he knows he's going to kick his ass. And what happens? The bloodiest day in American military history, September 17th, 1862, Battle of Antietam, or the Battle of Sharpsburg, as the men from the South call it. So it's, you know, there's so much history there, sir. I love it. I love it. I love it. All right. All right.
Well, and your listeners, again, who, depending upon where they live, of course, but for those who visit or happen to live in the Washington, D.C. area, that was one of the advantages, not too many, of being that close to the Beltway, but the number of wonderful Civil War battlefields that that were just a short drive away that offered an opportunity to really learn and to be inspired and to be touched by the service and sacrifice of those who went before us, and just amazing to see with your own eyes these locations. They just jump out at you like reading a book obviously cannot.
I used to, and I would take my kids, Daddy, the mosquitoes. You'll be okay. You'll be okay. I just want to read some more. Dad, come on. come home. Your wife looks at your kids. They're covered with mosquito bites. What happened? Like, I don't know. I don't know what happened. Dad wouldn't leave, Mom. He did that thing that he does where he's like got his books and he's reading and he's looking at maps. Like, what? You had fun? You had fun, didn't you? Shut up, okay?
Yeah, Max, that's the time you use with your kids the saying, I defend democracy, I don't practice it.
Exactly. You know what I did? I made them out of the sheet of plywood. I think I put my Marmaluke sword on the piece of plywood. I drew an outline of it, and then I cut it with a saber saw. And I made two of them, and I taped them up with duct tape. Right, and then I think I cut the sword at about maybe 2 feet or so, but they had their own little Marmaluke, their sawed off Marmaluke swords, and we'd go to the battlefields and they'd go running around like goofballs, you know. And so, you know, if you're out there, your kids don't need, when they're little, they don't need high end toys, piece of plywood. I made rifles like that too. I took my M1 Garand, traced a little bit of it, right. And I cut it. Please, duct tape it. Here you go, boys.
Yep. Those guys use their imagination rather than have their imagination taken away by intricate toys.
Right. And then you could get up there. You could get pissed at them. Why are your rifles laying on the garage floor? That's not how we. That's really pieces of wood, Dad. No, it's not. All right. They should be in the armory. Take care of them.
This is my rifle. There are many like it, but this one.
Exactly. You got to teach that stuff someplace. All right. Well, sir, first of all, thanks for doing this. Happy Independence Day.
Thank you, Mac. Enjoy.
And any parting words? You know, somebody else wrote an email. Let me read it real quick. Mac, I just want to echo the sentiment about praying over food, whatever you want to call that. Maybe some people won't call it prayer, but they join hands and somebody says something. Whatever we call that. Recalling the history of the country when you do that and then summoning other good forces is what we should do on a regular basis when these major events roll around. And I believe you're absolutely right. Not everybody will take it, but there will be some young people that will. It will spur some of their reading or watching of YouTube videos about the subject matter. And that is our responsibility to leave them with how fortunate they are to be Americans. And if we don't do that, shame on us. Their ignorance is our responsibility. Have a great weekend. Enjoy the program. All the best to General Dowdy, Semper Fidelis.
Yeah.
You know that's you know what, I like that. Their ignorance is our responsibility. That's,
you bet. Yeah, as I said, and teaching, so many of the students are historical illiterates, but that's not their fault. That's our fault. And so it's up to us to try to correct that, starting with our own families. I couldn't believe in anything more firmly. And it's, well, you know, the parents are first teachers, are the children's first teachers, are the parents. For parents, as you pointed out, also as leaders, that's our obligation to teach, to educate.
All right. One final email. Mac, how far is he going on the treadmill and at what rate? All right, Drowdy, we want to know about your PT program. How far and how fast?
Well, I set it for 4 miles an hour, and I knock out a little over 2 miles in that process. So about 30 minutes on the treadmill and then 30 minutes of other exercise. But I do it 7 days a week, so that should count for something.
You know, we're not going to mark you down because of your commitment, okay? We want to see 4.2 miles and 4.2 miles an hour and 2.2 miles, all right? So so get that done and let us know how you're doing.
I'll give you a report next time. You bet. I have my marching orders literally and figuratively here.
There you go. All right, sir. Always a pleasure. Thank you.
My pleasure, Mac. God bless you and Semper Fidelis to you and to all of our listeners.
There you have it. That is Sage 6-2, Tom Drowdy, Brigadier General, United States Marine Corps, retired, living down in the Tampa, Florida area. So he's a wonderful guy. All right, we're going to take a break. We're going to come back and check some news headlines, a couple emails, more of All Marine Radio coming up. Nukes!
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner's looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nielsen. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
America's injured and critically ill service members.
Hi, I'm Colleen McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
842. We continue. My thanks to Tom Drowdy for coming on. Call sign Sage 62. Here's an interesting email. Mac, it's interesting that their ignorance is our responsibility. I think there's a case to be made that we are more afraid to assert ourselves than they are to follow us. Just try it. You will be surprised. You know, I would echo that sentiment, and I think young people look for structure. And I think we did. I know I did. And I mean, I didn't need somebody telling me what to do every second of my life. But I'll tell you what, people that were smart, people that understood how to be successful, people that had successful habits, and there's a certain amount of structure that goes with that. I mean, I used to devour that kind of stuff. You know, I used to devour that. But we seem to be reluctant to interject ourselves. I'll tell you a quick story of me interjecting myself. Colleen, who you just heard, right, who's asleep in the bedroom next door to me. I have a studio in one bedroom. Colleen's snoring right next door. So we're going to see a movie. One of her friends is with us. And they're talking about, there's a prom. And the friend's talking about going with somebody, she's 15, going with somebody who's 18, who she met last summer. And I say, yeah, that's not happening. Colleen's like, Dad. I said, hey, look at me. And her friend looks at me, kind of smiling. I said, no, it's not happening. Okay. And then the next day, Colleen said to me, and we had this conversation about it. She said, hey, her friend, I won't say her name, she thought that was fun. I said, what, me telling her what to do? She said, no, that you cared and that you said no. And, you know, her dad doesn't talk with her about that kind of stuff, you know. And I said, yeah, well, that ain't happening, okay? Just so you know, that ain't happening. Colleen's like, no, I know. She's not going to go now. I said, good. All right, a few news headlines on this eve of the 4th of July. And again, whether they want to admit it or not, young people are thirsty for structure. Okay? They know what it is. And I'll tell you what, it's not hard. It's not hard to point it out. I can tell you in my family and the family of my ex-wife who, you know, and that's the family that my children live with, right? Look at the people that have had the hardest time in life. What's the common denominator? The common denominator is alcohol. Yeah. Alcohol and then other substance abuse. Look at my sister died of it. You know? She couldn't, you know, she went down that road and she could not extract herself from it. And ultimately died of exposure. Yeah. Horrible. So, I mean, again, young people need structure and we seem to be really reluctant to give it to them. You know, Look, they're not capable of making their own decisions when they're young, when they're adolescents. To allow them to decide, do you want it to be sage or a sandy tan color? Which would you prefer? Oh, well, there you go, limited choices as you learn how to operate without your training wheels. That's the way life is. That's the way successful people do it. You don't get hatched with the ability to make good decisions. Well, it's your decision. Like, what is your criteria to make a decision when you're 11? Exactly. It's stupid. So, again, don't be afraid to be an adult. Don't be afraid to be a leader. Don't be afraid to give them what they need, not what they want. It's a better way. So a few headlines. Marines in Taiwan. State Department officials are asking, but China's not happy about it. A detachment of 10 for security at the U.S. facility in Taiwan has much larger implications for U.S.-China relations, according to sources. Oh, yeah, that's because it steps on the Chinese toes, and nobody's allowed to do that. There's an article about fitness. This July 4th, remember, fitness fuels freedom. Written by a guy named Nick Berenger. Oh, by the way, Tractor Supply Company is giving 50% off. If you're in the military this weekend, so just so you know. So, anyway, as the 4th of July approaches, we rightly celebrate our nation's independence and remember the time that 13 upstart colonies took the fight to a larger, more powerful military and won their freedom. Although many factors lead to the birth of our nation, one factor that gets overshadowed is the military fitness brought to a sick, cold, and hungry cabal of Americans at Valley Forge by a Prussian by the name of Frederick von Steuben. His arrival in February of 1778 and the techniques he brought with him marked a, quote, singularly important event relative to future physical training in the U.S. Army. Yeah, Valley Forge, pretty interesting. What those soldiers went through, dying, if you will, in Valley Forge, but then becoming a military, is the foundation of the United States Army. Yep, that's it. Top five stories in Early Bird. Check that out real quick. Does the DOD know how to supply intel for cyber ops? Nobody even knows what cyber ops is, okay? Interesting story. U.S. considering troop withdrawal from Germany, according to a report. Yeah, why are we in Germany? We don't need to be in Germany anymore. We were in Germany when Europe was divided between East and West, and one of the reasons we were in Germany was that it was going to be the focal part of any offensive operations from the Soviet Union. It's not there anymore. The U.S. Department of Defense is examining options for withdrawing U.S. forces stationed in Germany after President Donald Trump expressed interest in such a move, according to the Washington Post. The newspaper, citing anonymous sources familiar with the evaluation, said officials were analyzing the cost and the consequences of shifting either some or all of 35,000 U.S. troops to the U.S. or to Poland, top defense officials said. U.S. Department of Defense rejected the Washington Post report on Friday evening of last week. A Pentagon spokesman told German newspaper DPA that the National Security Council had not received any cost analysis from the Ministry of Defense for relocating U.S. troops stationed in Germany. So the question is this something the president's serious about, or is this simply a negotiating tactic? So we will see. Germany spent 1.24% of its GDP on defense in 2017. The NATO target is 2%. Germany not even close, and plans to hit 1.5% by 2024. Okay, 2024 is in how many years? And Germany has an army, yes? No, Germany doesn't. Freeloading Germany does not have an army. Poland spends 1.99% of its GDP on defense in 2017 and is set to join only three other European NATO countries, the United Kingdom, Estonia, and Greece, that have met the alliance target. How pathetic is that? So, yeah. I would say, get us out of Germany. Get us to Poland. Get us to Poland. Let the Germans, you want to defend Germany, you defend it. We're out of that business. We've defended you and propped up your economy since World War II. We think we've done enough. Good luck. Yeah, I don't want to go down my Germany-hating rabbit hole, but I will if I have to. Three, immigrant kids could outnumber troops 4-1 at a Texas Air Force base. Okay. Thanks for the data point. Four, U.S. spy planes are breaking down and lawmakers want answers. America's aging C-135 reconnaissance planes keep breaking down and alarmed American lawmakers want the Air Force to tell them why. All right. Heather Wilson's got some. She's the Secretary of the Air Force. Five, European countries are quietly bringing back the draft. Whoa. Not the D word. Not the D word. Can you imagine how indignant? Is Francis... Is Francis Minister of Defense a female? Last week, France joined the growing number of European countries reintroducing mandatory national service, following through on President Emmanuel Macron's election promise. The government introduced a national service requirement for all 16-year-olds that will be divided into two phases. I love this, man. I love this. You owe something to your country. The first phase is mandatory and involves a month-long placement that focuses on civil culture. Young French citizens can look into teaching or work with charities or take part in traditional military training with the police, fire service, or the army. The second phase is an optional placement of between 3 months to a year where young people can work defense and security in social care, the environment, or in heritage, as it's known. How about that? By bringing back national service, the French government hopes to promote social cohesion and foster and sustain a more active sense of citizenship. Do you think that by extrapolation, maybe some of these people would be moved by their national service and get into politics and put the nation in front of their party? Wow, that would be interesting. I wonder. All right, couple overseas stories. U.S. troops unhurt in suicide bombing that reportedly killed Afghan civilians. The bomb went off in eastern Afghanistan, did not harm U.S. forces, did result in civilian casualties. Number two, President Xi of China claims in a meeting with U.S. Defense Secretary Mattis that China has a legitimate claim to the South China Sea. Nice. And there's a picture of Secretary Mattis looking very stern as he gazes across a table filled with flowers at President Xi. A look at recent developments in the South China Sea, where China is pitted against smaller neighbors in multiple disputes over islands, coral reefs, and lagoons in water crucial for global commerce and rich in fish and potential oil and gas reserve. President Xi, China, strongly asserted China's determination to defend territory it claims, including in the South China Sea, in a meeting with U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis. While the tone of Mattis's visit to Beijing is largely upbeat, Xi made sure to reinforce his reputation as a fervent nationalist when it comes to issues of sovereignty. Though Xi gave no specifics in his statement, he was largely seen as indicating that the South China Sea, as well as self-governing Taiwan, yikes, China also claims territory held by India and uninhabited East China Sea islands controlled by Japan. So can you see where that's a little bit of a problem? China claims land owned by India. China claims land owned by Japan. China claims via their nine-dash line the South China Sea. China claims Taiwan and the Taiwan Strait. Like, you got to be kidding. I'm looking for a quote from the Secretary of Defense. I don't see any. So we'll keep, maybe we'll get Grant on here later this week and talk about this meeting. Pretty interesting when the Secretary of Defense heads to China. Now, do you remember big hullabaloo? You know what? It's kind of interesting. All that hullabaloo about the travel ban, right? The quote unquote travel ban. Well, guess what? The president's got the right to do that. Here's another thing that you haven't seen as a headline anywhere, but it was alleged by in the media. According to a judge, President Trump did not tweet declassified CIA program information for the Syrian rebels. A tweet from President Donald Trump disputing aspects of a news report about the CIA program to aid Syrian rebels did not declassify the program or undermine the government's legal authority to keep details about it secret, a federal judge ruled in an opinion released on Monday. U.S. District Court Judge Andrew Carter rejected arguments that Trump effectively confirmed the existence of the program when he used his Twitter account last July to counter a Washington Post story that reported Trump's decision to end the effort, and suggested that the move was a concession to Vladimir Putin. Quote, here's the president's quote. The Amazon Washington Post fabricated the facts of my ending massive, dangerous, and wasteful payments to Syrian rebels fighting Assad, Trump wrote. A day after sending the tweet, Trump mentioned the Post story again. Armed with Trump's statements, the New York Times filed a Freedom of Information Act request demanding details of the program, then sued when the CIA did not immediately respond. So therein lies the lawsuit. But you don't hear that so much. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo headed to North Korea later this week for the resumption of talks aimed at the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. So we'll see what happens. All right, and let me see if there's any other. All right. No, that's enough of that. All right, so we're going to take a break. We'll get the Gunner on, see what he's got going. So don't touch that dial. More of Allmarine Radio on this day before the 4th of July. Best of Allmarine Radio coming up after this. So if you're bored or driving someplace, don't be afraid to flip it on. I don't know exactly what's going to be on, but it'll be good stuff nonetheless. So I know Ronnie Reyes is going to be part of it. Gold Star Sun, his story is awesome. So the Gunner. The Prince, coming up next.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.